This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Michael Cates. Today is 9 April, 2014. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Cates is joining me from his home via telephone in Cincinnati, Ohio. Mr. Cates, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some biographical information from you, if I may. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio.
And when were you born?
And when? It was October the 10th, 1948.
1948. Very good. And what were your parents' names?
Their names were Chester Cates, my dad's name, and Virginia Cates was my mother's name.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I got two brothers and three sisters.
Two brothers and three sisters. Where did you fit in the numbering there?
I'm the last one.
You're the youngest. Okay, the baby of the family.
Last one.
Very good. What did your parents do for a living there in Cincinnati?
My mom was a regular housewife. They're both deceased, by the way.
Okay.
And like I said, my dad worked for a department store.
Which department store was it, do you remember?
It was a place called Pogue's.
Hmm.
It was like a Federated department store type of deal.
Mm-hmm.
His regular world, really shopper clothes and stuff like that.
And what was your father's job there?
He was a freight elevator operator.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, tell me about growing up there in Cincinnati in the 1940s and 1950s. What was that environment like for you?
It was, we didn't have the crime like we got today.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty safe. I could walk anywhere, play anywhere. Nobody would bother you. But it was very safe. I never felt threatened by the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And, we lived in a poor neighborhood, so I went to. I always walked to school. We were very poor. We didn't have no transportation, so we had to walk or take a bus wherever we went.
What kind of activities were you involved in as a young one?
I used to play baseball,
mm-hmm.
And I tried basketball. I didn't care for that too much, but I was in the Cub Scouts. Started Boy Scouts, and I love to fish,
mm-hmm.
And I still do that as of today.
I could tell by your email address that Fisher is in there.
Oh yes.
So I thought maybe you might have a love for fishing.
Oh yeah.
Well, tell me about school. Where did you go to school?
Well, I started off at St. Monica School, my grade school, and my father died when I was. In the eighth grade, so then we had to move from our house to another location, close to the bus line. And then I went to high school on where I was located. It was Western Hills High School was the high school I went to, and it was a pretty good school. I wasn't the smartest of everybody, but it was interesting.
Yeah. You mentioned that your father passed away when you were a young boy. What was the cause?
Oh, he had cancer.
Hmm.
He smoked a lot. He would try to time it with smoking. He would. He died when he was 52 years old.
Hmm.
And I was 13 at the time. I just turned 13 when he passed away.
That certainly must have been tough for the family, obviously.
Yeah. That's when I would say that's when I really grew up.
Do you mind talking about that?
Like I say, being the youngest there, it was pretty close, but everybody in our family had their own interests and stuff like that. My brother and I, we liked to play sports. But like I say, it was kind of rough there, And we were so poor that... that's when, usually around Thanksgiving and Christmas time, church organizations would bring food to us and stuff like this. My mom had to finally get a job, which back in them days, women stayed home.
Mm-hmm.
So then she had to go out and get a job. She got a job at the library, and that's where she worked at. And we, us kids, had to take care of ourselves until she came home.
Yeah. Hmm. I'm taking you back to your education here. You mentioned that maybe you weren't the greatest student, but things seemed like things went pretty well. What sort of topics or subjects were you interested in school?
Most of the subjects I was interested in, like biology, things they had to do with the outside, stuff like that, zoology.
Mm-hmm.
Math, I was good at math, science. History, I thought was boring. But I found that very, when I got in the military, I seen a lot of stuff, you know, where the American Revolution, not American Revolution, but the, back in the Gettysburg and some Jamestown, Yorktown, and I actually got to see them sites, and I started getting really interested in history then.
Hmm.
And if I would have had that type of teaching in school, say, let's go here, go there, I would have really took up on that.
I'm sure.
Because reading the books just doesn't really get it for me. You know, I'm the you show me and I'll pick it up real fast. You know, if I read stuff in a book, I might have to read it a couple of times before I grab hold of it.
Mm-hmm.
And still, in all, I'm most or less the you show me and I'll do it.
Right. Now, did you consider or continue to play sports?
No, I didn't. Like I say, after my father passed on and we kept moving from different places, I don't know, my mom had to have them, I guess trying to find cheaper rent or something, I don't know. But we moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't pursue any sports whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because when I was old enough, when I was in high school, I started taking jobs on with different jobs. And when I was in high school, I more or less worked. I didn't enjoy my high school because in order for me to have any money, I had to work for it.
Sure.
Nothing was given to me because, like I say, we were too poor. So I worked at various jobs to make money. I sold newspapers. I delivered newspapers. Anything to make money, that's what I was doing. Shoveling snow when the snow came in the wintertime. Cutting grass. I started saving, like a little savings account, you know, so I'd have some money, like a little bit older for a car.
Mm-hmm. Now, growing up there in the 50s and into the 1960s, of course, when we look at the global politics of the time, this is an era dominated by the Cold War. What do you remember about the Cold War from the 50s and 60s?
I remember, the Cuban crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can say how our ships, you know, circled, you know, with Cuba there, and how we were in bad terms with Russia. Khrushchev was the Russian leader at the time. And it seems like, you know, everybody was afraid we thought maybe we'd be getting into a war, especially if Cuba was going to get all these missiles there they could fire here and hit the United States, which was never happened before. You know, so, of course, politics, why that's done, and I remember when Kennedy was assassinated. I was in junior high at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was assassinated. And I guess it was, politically, it was definitely a trying time for the United States.
Yeah. And given the background that you had and moving your way through high school, was there something that you wanted to do in particular when you graduated from high school, when you finished there? Or did you know for sure what you wanted to do?
Well, I really didn't know what I wanted to do after I got out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't have no guidance, you know, to say, well, you got to pursue this or pursue that. I knew I couldn't afford college because my mom couldn't afford that.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I wasn't going to college, so I figured, well, I might as well just join the service. And I thought, well, this way I can learn a trade. So once I get out of service, I'll have a trade.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried the Air Force and the Navy first, took the test and everything. There was like a year back up, year and a half. And of course, back then, they still had the draft.
Right.
So what I decided to do, well, I said, well, I'm going to join the Army so I get to pick what I want to do, just so I can have some learning.
Mm-hmm.
They could teach me how to do this, a trade. Well, the recruiter back then, you know, I signed up for engineer, run for operate bulldozers, learn how to do backhoes and stuff like this. But he just put down engineer. When I got the basic training, you're going to be a combat engineer. And I told him, well, I didn't sign up for, you know, like combat engineer. I want to run bulldozers and backhoes and stuff like that. He says, well, you're going to be what we're going to give you. You know, you're going to take, you can't do nothing about it. You're going to be what we tell you we're going to be. And today they don't do that. So if you sign up, that's what you want to be, that's what you're going to be. That's what you get out. So I got stuck being a combat engineer. And that didn't help me once I got out of here. Because I couldn't blow nothing up, you know.
Yeah, there's limited use for that afterward, I guess.
True.
Well, let me ask you this. This is what, 1966, 1967, probably, right? When did you graduate high school?
I graduated in 67.
Okay, 67. So you graduate in 67. The Vietnam War is obviously full bore at this point. It's on the news at night. There's a large national conversation about the Vietnam War, the debate over whether or not we should be there, how we're fighting, all of that is going on. What do you remember about this time and the environment surrounding the Vietnam War?
Well, I figured, well, I'd be going to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You know, they more or less told you that when I went our advanced training. And back then, as far as the war demonstrations and stuff like this, I really didn't pay a whole lot to it, you know. My thought of training was, you know, okay, we were trying to go to Vietnam to defeat the spread of communism. That South Vietnamese would have their say-so, the religion, freedom of the speech, religion, just like we got here in the United States. And that's exactly what, in a way, I felt back then. I didn't really, you know, give it a whole lot of thought besides that I go to Vietnam, you know, to help fight communism.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all those movements, like they call it Moonies. Reverend Moon, I think, was from what country he was from, that started that religious group. I remember seeing them at the airports, you know, and when they seen service people, they didn't really care for service people.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were baby killers and drug addicts and everything else that came back. You know, I can think of it right now.
Yeah, sure. So you enter the service, I guess, what, the summer or fall of 1967 then, right after high school?
Yeah, it was August of 1967.
August of 67. Where did you go for basic training?
I went to Fort Belvoir, Virginia. I went to Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay.
My basic training.
Take me through your basic training. What was that like there?
It was hot. I never seen so much sand before in all my life, you know. And pine trees everywhere, and they told us that they were gonna rush us through. You know, usually basic training is 8 weeks. They were gonna rush us through about 6.5 weeks. And it seems like first thing we did in the morning, we got up probably about 5 o'clock, 5:30, and we'd have an assembly out in front, and then we'd run probably about, start off about 2 miles a day, and it kept increasing it, you know. And what that base was an airborne base. And that's where they taught guys how to jump out airplanes and stuff like that. So it was a vigorous training and a lot of camping and stuff. And we stayed till quite late, you know, and just eat that they were rushing us. The basic training.
Mm-hmm. How well did you do in basic training? Was it something you had adapted to pretty quickly, or was it something that was a struggle for you? How did it go for you?
You know, I adapted real well because I'm an outside person anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I liked camping to begin with, and I was an outside person, and I really enjoyed it. You know, there were some guys that I was in group there that really couldn't handle it, you know. I remember one guy had to get out. He was just too stressful for him. And but like I say, the training they gave me was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Yeah. What was your basic daily routine like there? You mentioned waking up early, the runs, the bivouacking and things like that. What other sort of things were you involved with there?
Anyway, like I say, they showed us how to use the, at the time it was the M14 rifle,
mm-hmm.
and how to, take it apart, put it back together. And we'd go to rifle ranges, shoot. We did a lot of shooting there. Once we zeroed in the rifles, and we shot down these silhouettes that would pop up. And also it showed us, mostly a lot of physical exercise, a lot of PT training. I guess in shape. But we had some class work, of course, about the, military justice system. If you do this and do that, you get thrown in a brig and stuff like this. And, but that's most of what I can remember is just a lot of physical exercise.
Yeah.
Running and shooting. They have these like silhouettes up, not silhouettes, like dummies standing up and show how to use a bayonet, how to stand first and run off to the next person and stuff like this. And, a little bit of hand-to-hand combat. That's all I can remember as of right now.
Sure, sure. Well, after basic, you go to AIT. Where was that for you?
Okay, that was at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Okay. Take me through your AIT.
Excuse me?
I said, take me through your AIT.
Okay, my AIT got there, I guess, in October. Sometime now, of course. We're going to rush it through. D1 is done by Christmas time. So that was going to be a rush. Okay, that is where they taught me my combat engineer skills.
Mm-hmm.
We learned how to build bridges. We learned about explosives. We learned how to build buildings, roadways, how to read a map. And we were introduced to the M16 rifle at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that they could be using to go to Vietnam. And how to use tried out one bazooka, and then there was another thing. It was a rock-propelled, I want to call it like a grenade or something like that. It comes out of a tube, called a log, and that was an anti-tank weapon also. And then also we went doing some more camping again. Because I remember one time how many miles we went and set the tents up and everything. And, it was really cold. The next morning there was snow all over the ground. That was probably about it for the AIT.
Now, here at AIT, things are a little bit different. It's a different pace of life. You're probably treated a little bit differently than you were at boot camp. Do they tell you that, look, Cates, at the end of this, you're going to Vietnam. Do you know at this point that you're going to be going to the war zone?
Towards the end, they told us that.
Yeah.
They said it was some people that could be going to Germany, and the rest of us be going to Vietnam. So, because combat engineers were in demand over in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We had to do so much stuff. We were still infantry, but then your combat engineer skills, they were extra besides the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
We had to, more or less get a landing zone for our fireplace bases and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't learn anything in my training whatsoever about what a fire base was or how to clear them. We didn't learn that until we got over there.
Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts upon receiving orders for Vietnam?
Well, it didn't surprise me. I sort of figured I was going to be going over there. There's nothing I could do about it. So when I got the orders from the Gaming, 3 weeks before I had to report to Fort Lewis, Washington, which was my dispatch place to go to Vietnam. But like I said, it didn't surprise me. None of it. My main thing is, how am I going to hide it from my mom? You know, because she was such a worried work there.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she wasn't going to take it. So I really didn't tell her till about 2 or 3 days before I was leaving, because I didn't want her to worry.
Yeah. Now, did you go back home to Cincinnati when you had when you finished with AIT?
Yeah, we got on the Greyhound bus. And I came to Cincinnati. Like I say, it was definitely cold winter time.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, I hung out with my friends, and you know, we took in shows at the mall and stuff like this. It was too cold to do any fishing, so I didn't do any fishing.
Right.
Well, I hung out with my friends, and then I told my brother, I told him, he was still home at the time, he wasn't married, and I told him, I said, I'm going to be going off, I said, don't tell mom, and I go tell her about, so it's almost time to leave, you know, so that's what I did.
You had this, month, probably 3 weeks, I guess, or something like that, before you go to Vietnam. And you mentioned that you were withholding this from your mother, not telling your mother that you were going. How did you react when you finally broke the news to her?
Oh, I remember very well. I was out in the kitchen, and I had my sisters and my brother there, you know, and I told her, I said, sit down, well, I want to tell you something. So she started crying. She says, I think I know. I said, yeah, I'm going to Vietnam. And then that really tore her up. And like I said, it was, you know, I hate to see my mom crying and stuff. And first thing she knows, you know, you think about, you know, I could be killed, I could be wounded. And I said, yeah, you'll be fine, you know, don't worry. But, you know, you tell your stuff like that, you know, but you know they're going to worry anyway.
Sure. You have to say it, and she has to worry. That's just the way the arrangement works.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I know how that is, because I got two boys of my own.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, what about you? Had you been paying any more attention to what was going on in Vietnam, whether television, radio, or just talking to folks?
No, I really wasn't paying that much attention to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew where I'm going to be. I'm going to be going over there. I'm going to know what is true, what's not true, you know. So just getting some of the TV reports, I wouldn't know how accurate things were or whatever.
Yeah. And you remember that at the time, kind of questioning what was being seen on television and reported in the papers?
Really in deep thought, I never thought about that at the time. I was just thinking, you know, how much killing is really going on. It's always, you know, the Americans are always winning all the battles and stuff like this. You
mm-hmm.
hear about, well, what about the enemy? Are they winning any battles and stuff like that? Well, I didn't hear anything about, you know, the enemy winning anything. It's always the United States, all the bombers and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting point of view there. Okay, here we are. It is, January, I guess, of 1968. You've got your orders for Vietnam. When do you leave?
I left January the 8th, 1968.
Okay. Now, you left to, or out of Fort Lewis, you said.
That is correct.
Describe that trip over for me. How did you get to Vietnam, and what was that trip like for you?
Okay, I happened to get on an airplane, and it was like a commercial airline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what reminds me of. And nothing but military personnel on there who was going to Vietnam. And it told us the route we were going to go. We were going to head towards Alaska. We weren't going to stop, though. And we were going to come on down to Japan. Okay, we were going to stop off Japan. Stay there for maybe about a couple hours, I guess, to refill or something. And from there, we're going to go to Vietnam. You know. And I remember it was snowy in Washington when we left. Very cold, and so that I could see, you know, it was pretty, it was kind of quiet on the plane going on over there. It took, I want to say, a good 12 hours, I think, to get up. I knew it was the longest sit-down time I ever had. I was really glad to get up out of the seat.
I'm sure. All right, you come into Vietnam from Japan. Did you fly into Rushesky? Where did you fly into? What base?
We flew into Cam Ranh Bay.
Okay. So you fly into Cam Ranh Bay. Here we are in January of 1968. Do you depart here from Cam Ranh Bay? Is this where you go out to find your unit?
Yeah, it was like a holding area.
Yeah. Well, describe the environment there at Cam Ranh Bay. You arrive, the doors open on the plane. What is it like when you are introduced to Vietnam?
Okay, when the plane was landing, stuff like that, we all thought, well, once the plane stops, it's going to help the plane run. You know, the enemy's going to fire at us or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what to expect. So after we land, stuff like that, they told us, you know, don't nothing worry. It's a secure base and stuff like this, so you don't have to worry about anything. So we could get off the plane, walk. It was hot as can be. You know, we would go from a cold environment into a hot environment. And you see all these trucks and jeeps and stuff moving all over the place. Like it's a regular city, nothing. Nobody's worrying about anything, the way it looks. But that was our holding area for a few days. I shouldn't say a few days. I lasted there for about a week. Before I was told to where I was going to report to.
What do you do for this week?
Okay, for that week there, we had to fill out papers. Next of kin, in case you die, you want your parents to know that you've been injured, wounded, and it was just a little paperwork, stuff like that, you know, because usually in basic, you fill out so many other papers to begin with. The military's got that. It's just, you know, you have to fill out your insurance papers, who the beneficiary you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And more or less, it was just sitting around waiting. And every morning, we would have a roll call. And at that time, they would say, you know, they would call out a number of people. Okay, you guys are going to go here. You guys are going to go there. So, I guess it was probably about the third or fourth day I was there when they called my name. And that's when they say, well, you're going to go to play cool. Yeah, I figure, what is play cool? You know, where's that at? You know, but, and so then, that's, well, my time was. Mostly Cam Ranh Bay to play two. I got on another airplane. They took us to play two. Took probably about, I don't know, about an hour flight, something like that. That's when I got to play two.
What did play two look like when you arrived there, January of 68?
Okay, there was all kind of wooden structure or places where like people stayed at. There was it was a great big base. I remember bunkers surrounded all the way around it, all the barbed wire all the way around it, and of course it was nice and hot. It was dirty, sandy, and that's when I started, well, we're getting out toward the field now, you know, because it was probably about, oh, they had their fights every once in a while, you know, the firefights. And, of course, you get rockets shot into the fire base from time to time. Wherever they land, that's where they land. And I don't think you had that much accuracy. You know, you figure they shoot a few rockets and run, you know. But, yeah, I felt pretty safe there because the way the perimeter was set up. And, of course, you got guards there 24 hours. And the way the field of fire was, when you had the concertine wire, you had this great big long section. I guess it's probably about 200 feet long. They had mines in it, you know, anti-personnel mines. The enemy got through the wire into the minefield. So up to slow them down so our guys can shoot them, you know, as they're coming toward our inside our perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt pretty safe there, you know.
Yeah. I should ask you, what unit were you assigned to?
I was assigned to the 4th Combat Engineer Battalion, 4th
okay.
Infantry Division.
And what were you going to be doing there at Pleiku once you get settled in?
Once we got there, we were issued equipment, and we would be taken out to the field. This were our backpacks, our sleeping bags, socks, one pair of pants and shirt there, something like that. Then when we were issued a rifle when we got there, and then what we would do is after about a day or two, then we would go to like the firing range. They would issue some rounds of ammunition. We'd go outside the base, and we would target practice, zero in our rifle. And like I say, then we'd write letters or go to a movie or something there. Just kill the time until we were assigned another where we're going to go out next.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that was just that's what I called our, like a base camp, you know, our safe haven right there.
Right, right. Well, tell me about what it was like for you to come into a unit. Are you coming in there by yourself? Were you the only replacement coming in at this time, or were there others?
No, there was others. There was probably about a dozen other ones coming.
Okay,
on.
Quite a few then, yeah.
And like I said, none of us knew what to expect, you know. Or when we going to get out into the woods and stuff like this, when we're going to see any action, things like that.
Yeah.
So, like I say, after we were there, play coup there, you know, they teach us, we had to go out on maneuvers after we zeroed in on rifles. So it was like the beginning of what was going to happen once we leave play coup, once we get to our another section.
Mm-hmm.
So we get our gear together, we go on a mission, like search and destroy, looking for the enemy and stuff like this. We get on top of the hill, we digging for the night, and then just wait in case, you know, and see if we report any activity or stuff, which we did. And then the next day we would go back and do some more checking around, try to find the enemy out, and then we'd go back into the camp itself. And that lasted like for about probably about 4 or 5 days.
And what was this like for you? I mean, you had been trained in AIT as a combat engineer, and obviously you had other infantry training as well. But, you know, your specialty was going to be something different rather than going out on these patrols. What was it like for you to go out on these patrols, and what role did you play? Take me out on some of these patrols.
Okay. Everybody in the military, their number one thing is they're all infantry. Their second is like an MOS being trained. Okay, regular infantrymen, their MOS is additional infantry training, where mine was combat engineer training.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I knew I was infantry, but out in the field out there, since I learned about, you know, cutting trees down, building stuff, and going on missions, we were trained, you know, on how to go on a mission and stuff. But I don't know. I guess I had to go with the flow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say jump. You know, it didn't do any good to question anything over there. And then, like I say, we were just there until, you know, play coup, until I got my other destination, which was another like camp, similar but a lot smaller in size.
Mm-hmm.
And there we go out to the field from there. So I went from play coup to Dock Till after about 4 or 5 days at play coup.
Mm-hmm.
got was better. Big place, but not as big as Lake Cool. And then from there, we flew out on choppers, you know, to they told us there at dock to what infantry unit we were going to be assigned to. Now, there was only about 6 to 10 combat engineers assigned to an infantry division. So there was four companies of infantry. There would be about 6 to 10 of us guys, you know, assigned to them. And whenever the infantry needed stuff done, blown up, or a landing zone put in, we would do that.
Yeah.
We had to secure the fire bases. What a fire base is more or less like King of the Hill. When you play, when you were kids and stuff like that, whoever took the highest ground is the winner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what we did here. We would take the hill, and we'd cut down trees and stuff like that, and make a field of fire. And we had to get enough trees down in order for the helicopters to come in. They can land the choppers, and this way we get our supplies. Choppers would fly right back off.
How would you get the trees down? Were you using dead cord? Were you cutting them down? How are you getting the trees down?
Okay, how are we getting the trees down? Well, first of all, we try to use our chainsaw. Pullman and Remington were the two chainsaws that we would be using.
Hmm.
Okay, a lot of times we had to throw the chainsaws out to the choppers. A lot of times, you know, you had to jump about pretty high up, unless because you didn't repel down, you know. We do, and once the choppers got low enough, we had to jump out the choppers and start to cut trees down so that they could land a little bit better. They usually found some spot that they could get close enough to, because once they get to a hill, they would shell a lot of their jets would bombard it, or artillery would get it, or mortar, stuff like that. They would clear a pretty good spot,
mm-hmm.
you know. A lot of times the choppers came on in and landed. But those places where they couldn't, that's when we used the chainsaws. Very seldom did we use explosives at that time for the knocking the trees down, only on special missions. My last one is when I had to use explosives on trees to blow a lot of trees down at one time. But the chainsaws, I can say that was hard work once you drop them trees down.
I'm sure.
Once they're dropped down, then choppers, like I say, can land. And then your supplies can come in.
Now, here in the Central Highlands, when you're knocking these trees down, obviously there are a lot of trees to knock down for to prepare a spot for a fire base. What becomes of the trees? Someone hauling them off, you leaving them there, you moving them to a side. What's going on there?
Okay, you know, what happens to the trees? Excuse me. What we would do, we would get them out of the way. I guess, the infantry definitely helped out on mm-hmm. stuff like that, because part of their interest too, the more we cleared out of the way. So we would drop them down. Plus, we would use some of them trees for our bunkers
mm-hmm.
that we would make. So we would cut the trees up in so many sections. Like I said, and we built all the fence to make bunkers. So with a lot of infantry, they would take the trees and just put the top of their bunkers before they put sandbags on top for reinforcements. So again, there was only one time where I had this great big tree I had to get rid of, and that's why I used C4 on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I put enough C4 on there. I can't tell you what happened to that tree. It just disappeared.
Well, I think this is very interesting, Mr. Cates, in that I don't know how many people are familiar with what it would actually take to clear out and build a fire base, but you being a combat engineer are in a really good position here with your experiences to tell me how this would take place. If you don't mind, take me through each down and dirty step of creating a fire base from from the time you cut the trees down? What's the next step? What goes on next?
Okay, once you get the trees down, stuff like that, of course you got the imprint guys setting up a perimeter for security. And then you've got everybody build a bunker. We got all these sandbags and stuff like that. You dig your bunkers probably about 4 to 5 foot down, you know, and all that dirt you're using, you put into the sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
And what the sandbags for is for making the tops of your bunkers to make them secure as possible. Okay, a lot of times they dig holes. You would, like I said, some of the trees that we had, you know, that we knocked down, we would put that on top of the hole. Then we would put sandbags on top of that. We would put between 3 to 4 layers of sandbags on top of our bunker there. And then also, you would make a section, like a cutout, like for a field of fire, you know, in case we got hit.
Mm-hmm.
You would have something to hide behind and start shooting at the enemy. We'd also have like a hole down into the bunker itself the same way. Usually when you pull guard duty at night, you're on top of the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is when you start listening for movements and see if anybody's coming around, you know, what have you. So once you got your bunker fixed, then you want to secure the base, you know, the fire base.
Mm-hmm.
So what everybody does, we got this, what you call concertina wire. Concertina wire is barbed wire and rolls and circles. It comes like a 10-foot length. You open it up and stretch it, and then you clamp it down. So some means of a holder, like a U-clamp to keep it down into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that all the way around your perimeter. You do that with one wire. Then you go back and lay it side by side. So now you got two rows all the way around. And then you put one row of concertina wire on top of that, making like a triangular type of shape, you know, with concertina wire. Okay, the purposes of that, of course, is to secure your base, because most of your fighting is done at nighttime over there. At least that's what it was with me. The concertina wire will keep the enemy out, so you've got definitely to be shooting the daylight. They're that crazy to come up to your concertina wire, and they're 9 10 out of 10, they're going to get shot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you would set up a fire base. And after that, and during the nighttime, or right before it got evening time, you would have so many infantry guys, usually about 4 guys, that would go beyond your perimeter as a listening post at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
And what they would do, they'd listen for enemy activity. If you hear, if they heard any noise, something, they'd radio back saying, you know, we're hearing activities, stuff like this. If it got too dangerous, they came back in. So, and then just wait and see if anything would happen. But that's what mostly the fire base consists of there. You know, a lot of bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of work involved. And the main thing, as I say, was your security.
Right, right. Now, this was obviously big enough for helicopters to come in, land, resupply, things like that.
Exactly.
Was it big enough for a mess hall, administration, anything like that?
Okay. The usually there was a command bunker,
mm-hmm.
and every time we were on a hill, well, most of the hills, well, depends how long we were going to stay for. Some hills we didn't stay for very long, maybe about 2 weeks. But if they knew we were going to stay there longer, then we'd make a command bunker. This way, all the officers, I guess, they plan their strategies. They were also there to call in artillery. We needed that, or call the jets in, gunships, stuff like this.
All right. Now, once you have the fire base built, it's secure, and you're going to be there for a while, what are you going to be doing? Are you going to be going back out on patrol? Or are you going to be doing combat engineer duties on the base? a day off from time to time. What is the pace of life for you like there once you get the fire base established? What do you do?
Once the fire base is established, we went around during the daytime to make sure the wire still held in place. Also, we would make what you call shitters. You know, of course, you kind of have to go to the bathroom when you're in the field and stuff. So we would make these wooden houses, you know, about 2 to 3 people one time could use them. And we would make them. We would also, all depends if there was, if they built the, like a tunnel along the sides of connected from bunker to bunker. Made sure that those were, you know, were big enough, stuff like this, to stay in. But then during the daytime, like I say, we would, of course, definitely eat. Write letters, receive mail. But our main thing was to make sure things were secure, because most of the time the infantry were the guys that went out on the patrols.
Mm-hmm.
We also made what you call food gas bombs,
mm-hmm.
which was like napalm. And that consisted of a 55-gallon drum of diesel. We had to dig a hole on an angle with that barrel, 55-gallon drum on an angle. We put this special mixture in there to make it real thick. Before we stuck the barrel on the angle, we put a, what you call, a shape charge behind it. And what the shape charge does, when we're under attack, we relay the wire from the shape chart back to the bunker behind there. So, and we give a detonator. We would give the infantry guys there. What just happened? We got attacked. The enemy would come that side. The infantry blew the food gas, which was like napalm. It would blow up into a great big ball of fire and get on the clothing of the enemy. And then that way, that was another way of slowing the enemy down, easier for knocking them off.
Right. Now, did you have
I think that's what it consists of.
Yeah. You mentioned mail. How often were you getting mail?
We would get mail about every, I would say, about every 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
We would get mail. We would send... One guy would go in, go down to the, like the base camp, and pick up our mails and anything and other supplies we might need, and then hop a chopper and come out back to the top of the hill there again.
Yeah. Did you write home quite often or receive mail quite often?
I received mail probably about once a week. I wrote about at least that too. Whenever I had found time to write, because if we were too busy doing the daytime, in our bunkers, we had candles, you know, we'd light a candle, and so as long as you could not be seen on the outside, you know, we draped all that stuff down so there was no light shining on the outside, and this way we could write our letters, and then we would give the letters to, like, the helicopter gunship machine gunner on the side.
Mm-hmm.
But all the helicopters would have these there's a machine gun on both sides of the helicopter, and there was a guy that sat in that chair there. So we'd go up and say, here, we'd mail this for us. Or some of the guys were going back down into the camp, they would take them, they would mail them for us. And we didn't have to worry about postage, but it was free postage.
Right.
But yeah, we would get boxes. We've got candy, toothpaste, and cookies, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, which we really look forward to.
I bet it was quite a boost for morale.
Oh, it was. And everybody shared, you know, like, dude, whenever anybody got packed or something, we all shared amongst each other.
Yeah.
We were a pretty close-knit little Sam family, I would say.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Now, I want to talk about that in a moment. But getting back briefly to the letter writing in your actual family, did you write your mother, I assume?
Yes, I wrote my mother.
What sort of things would you tell her? You knew that she was, you know, she was there by herself, largely. She's worried about her youngest son being in the middle of the war. How did you handle that?
Well, I tell you what I told her. I told her I was a cook. That's what I said. I'm not seeing no action, nothing like that. I'm fixing these meals, stuff like this. I told her that so she wouldn't worry.
Is that right?
And I got away with that for a good while, until she was working with this one young girl down there. She was trying to step me up with, because I wasn't going to anybody at the time. And she recorded this message on this tape recorder and sent it to me. And one of the guys happened to have one of the tape recorders, and I played it. I'm listening to her message. You know, I played one back, and I told her what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she didn't know I was hiding this from my mom.
Oh, no.
So I got away with that for about 7 months.
Hmm.
But then my mom really found out. Excuse me. But see, my brothers knew, and my sisters knew.
Mm-hmm.
Because see, what I was doing, especially my oldest brother, I carried a camera with me over there. And every time I took pictures, I would send to him to have him develop for me. But he was married and stuff like that, so my mom didn't do none of that stuff.
Yeah.
So then he would send me back some more films so I could take some more pictures. You know. So that's how my brothers. Mom, no, not until she got that tape recording. That girl played it, and that's when she, like I say, she found out.
Hmm.
And I got mad at the girl for doing that.
Now, you mentioned that you were a very tight-knit group there, and obviously this is one of the things that happens in units like this, especially during wartime. But I wonder if you might be able to give me some, you know, some more details on who the people were, what the interactions were like, how do you deal with one another, what sort of things do you do to pass your time. Just tell me about the relationship of the guys that you knew in your unit.
Well, of course, we were all from different states. And we would talk all about what we all like to do, what you like to hunt, you like to fish, you know, what all your hobbies were. What was your state like? What's it known for? And like I say, we were pretty close on to that. And like I say, we got to know each other very, very well. You know, and it seems like, you know, when you guys get your Dear John letters, you know, from their girlfriends back home, you know, and then we try to help them out there, saying, you know, you'll find another girlfriend or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And but that, like I say, we worked good together. You know, there was no fighting, no squabbling amongst each other and stuff like this, because you had to get along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we had to rely on each other. So.
What did you guys do to pass the time?
Well, we would, of course, you know, when we had the activities during the daytime, we had to do work details. That was part of, like I said, and every once in a while, you know, when guys would come back out of the field, they'd bring some beer, we'd drink some beer, and pop, and listen to music.
What kind of music?
Oh, we'd have this Vietnam station over there. Remember the name of them, but anyway, they would play all these good records back in the 60s, there, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one of the guys named, his girlfriend was named Gloria. Oh, and you heard that song, Gloria. Everybody was singing that song. And like I say, give me a ticket for an airplane. Mm-hmm. Don't have time to take the fast train, you know. That was another good one. And, let's see, we love to listen to the music, and that was mostly in the evening time, you know. And there were some times where our bunkers were not right on the front of the perimeter. They had us back ways further, so that we didn't have the pool watch at night time. So that was nice, too. I could say there was, in our bunkers, we had anywhere between, I guess, 4 to 8 guys to a bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And they would tell stories about our home life, what we're going to do when we get out of service. And we actually had some guys that were from Germany. They're American stationed in Germany. They actually volunteered to come to Vietnam because they said they got so tired of being in Germany. They were out in the fields all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so cold. It's just, you know, they couldn't stand that cold and stuff. The BS that came along with it over there in Germany. So they decided they wanted to come to Vietnam.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, so I don't think I would do that, but I don't know. I'm putting in your shoes.
Right. What was the racial or ethnic makeup of your unit?
Most of us were white. We had one guy who was black. And, but like I say, we got along like it was nothing. And
mm-hmm.
We had this one guy, he was from Hawaii. Now, we were told to protect him whenever we got in a firefight due to the fact that he looked just like the enemy, you know.
Mm.
And we called him Oops back then, you know.
Yeah.
And, but we had to make sure that, that he wasn't shot by one of our own guys.
Hmm. Now, you've set up the fire base. You've kind of given me an idea of the pace of life is like there. The components, component parts, I guess, of your unit, the relationship with the guys, what you're doing in your pastimes. What is your military life like? What kind of operations are you being sent on? What sort of things are you responsible for, both inside the fire base typically, and moving outside?
And moving out what?
And moving outside of the fire base. Are you going on patrols? Are you part of larger missions? Are you going out to construct things or destroy things? What are you doing?
Yeah, we would go out on different missions. All depends on how long they were going to be. On our missions, we would say probably about, we'd be going around, maybe about a half a day. We'd be going to the jungles and stuff like this, checking things out. We're just looking for the enemy at times. And a lot of times, we didn't get in any firefights like that. But we knew the enemy was around, so people leave stuff around where his camp was at and stuff like this. One time we got on the one fire base, and we ran them off, you know, I guess with all the explosions and the, from the artillery and the jets and stuff like this. And we came on in, and it happened to be a great big bamboo area. I didn't know bamboo grew out there on woods like that, but it did. We had one guy who rappelled out of a chopper. And he slipped and fell on the bamboo, and bamboo hit him right in the testicles.
Mm.
Knocked one of them out, and we had to evacuate him out of there.
Oh, my.
And then we had cut down some more bamboo so that the choppers could land down through there, which wasn't too hard because bamboo was easy to cut.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got that, everything started landing in. The NVA, they left mortar rounds. We knew that there was a mortar pit there. They left some anti-personnel mines there. And they were scattered everywhere, you know. So we got them all together since they didn't, you know, they weren't set or anything. Got them all together, and we blew them up, you know. And then in order for our field of fire for that evening, we had to blow all this bamboo up. So we had what you call a Bangalore torpedo. They used these like in the Second World War, mm-hmm. to blow up the wire extent on the perimeter. They're long tubes, probably about 6 foot long, probably about probably about 6 inches in diameter, and they're connected one after another. Well, we would connect about 6 or 7 of them at one time and slide them through the bamboo. We'd make a line probably about 50 foot, and then we would blow it. And it just got rid of all that bamboo, and we would do that until we got enough for our field of fire all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And after you blew the bamboo, you could see anti-personnel mines everywhere. They were scattered. I don't know what they were doing out in the woods there, but the NVA had them.
Hmm.
So then we would just set up base again, and I don't know, just until they figure out what we were going to do that day. You know, of course, we had to dig our bunkers again.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere we went, we had big bunkers.
So this might be a full day out, might be a half a day out, just kind of depended on the mission.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on how hot the area was,
mm-hmm.
whether or not, you know, we were getting incoming rounds coming in, and then the, like I say, some of the infantry guys would go on out and try to find them, where they were shooting the rockets from, or mortars.
As a combat engineer, would you typically stay back, or would you go on these patrols to try to find them?
Most of the time, the infantry went out. We
mm-hmm.
stayed behind until the whole unit was going to go. You know, there's only about one or two times where the whole unit, they just broke camp and just started going to this other hill.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spent a couple days here, a couple days there. We keep moving around. But whenever we move, it all depends on what missions and stuff like that. We had to carry extra ammunition for machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys had to carry extra mortar rounds, stuff like that. So once you get set up, you know, then you get that stuff back to the infantry. But yeah, a lot of times we didn't go on the patrols. But like I say, that was part of the infantry's main job.
So you go on a patrol, patrol's over, are you walking back or taking the helicopter's taking you back, depending on how far you would go out, I guess would be the answer to that.
Yeah.
Going back to DACTO?
Most of the time we would walk to the destination, especially walk on back.
Mm-hmm.
All depends if we were going to take another hill or not.
Yeah.
If we were going to take another hill, then we would always be in choppers, you know. After the hill was, blown to bits, I should say. If everything was on there, you know, it would be gone by now by the time we got over there.
Right.
But we got, we'd go to helicopter ride a lot of places.
So
it all depends on the mission.
Right. So you're going into and out of DACTO for the most part?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was in different other locations in DACTO, you know, like a couple of them, like Ben Hutt, Polly Klang, Pontoon. We went to all them areas. Some places we would fly into, well, both of them. The only place time we took a convoy, you know, from DACTO was the Pontoon.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't fly there.
Yeah, the roads were good enough that you could go ahead and convoy then.
Yeah, they were all, like I say, the roads were made, I think, by the French, but the French rode there before us.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I say, they were all dirt roads. They weren't no good during the monsoon season, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The roads were decent. I had to do mine speaking one a couple of times.
Tell me about that. That's, I think, a very interesting and underappreciated part of the American experience there. Take me on a mine sweeping.
Okay. When we did this mine sweep, we were flown to this one destination called Ben Hutt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We were told that we would mine sweep, you know, Van Hut to this one river where the bridge was at. That's where we had another camp at. The distance was approximately, I would say, about 10 miles. I would just take a guess at. And what we would do, we would have a convoy going from Van Hut to where we were going to go at, there, near at the bridge there. So we would get there's two mine sweepers, you know, at a time. One guy on each side of the road there goes to get big wide swaps there with your mine sweeper. You kept about 3 inches maybe off the ground, and any metal it detected, it would set off a beep.
Mm-hmm.
So once we get beeped in, everybody had to get off to the side there, you know. And there was one incident where mine went off. So I put my mine sweeper down, and then I start digging with my knife around the road there. Well, luckily I found one of our artillery rounds that was on the road. It was pointed on the up position instead of the down position.
Huh.
So they figured, well, what happened was this was a dud, you know, and that the NVA replanted it, put a charge underneath it in case we picked the round up, the charge would go off.
Right.
So what I did, I put a charge onto the artillery round, and then I put a timer on there, you know. I used a timing fuse instead of using the old wire with a blasting cap at the end with a dead cord. So everybody got out of the way, and then I yelled fire and hold, yelled that 3 times, and then it blew, you know. And then kept on going until we got to our destination, you know. But that was a safe one that time. Another time, we were going to make the same mine sweep again, and we had some, what you call the mountain yard troops with us. One of the tribes over there that the special forces were training to help defend their villages and stuff. Well, they were on patrol with us, and they flanked way on the outside of us while we were doing the mines. Well, we were come to this one section of the road when all of a sudden one of them found a wire that was run down towards the road. So we came down but close to me, so I cut the wire with a machete and found out where it led to. It led to an NVA Claymore mine. And what Claymore mine was set up, it's about 5 foot off the ground, like a tripod. Great big round, it's probably about 20 inches in diameter, and filled with explosives. And after we seen that, and then another person said another thing, found another wire, and then they cut that, then somebody yelled ambush, and then that's everything starts going off then, you know. And like I said, we got in a firefight then, and that's when we called in we happened to have 3 tanks with us, and they were shooting their rounds out the enemy. Well, I knew we had some on the NVA on the same side as I was on. You know, we had a few of them over there, and I told them, we got snipers from our side, you know, the back that I could hear the gun, you know, the AKs going off.
Now, who are you telling this to?
I was yelling this to the infantry.
Okay.
So some of the guys went into the woods, and they found where the NVA was at, and they killed, you know, there. And they had like a small bunk, just one, over there. So took care of that, and all hell was breaking. It's still loose, you know, where I was at. And then we had the gunships come in, and then after a while, then the spotter plane would come in. Shoot the smoke down, and then the fighter jets came. And we hit, all had to get on the other side of the road when the jets were coming in, because they were dropping napalm.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, when they dropped that stuff, it was hot, believe me.
Yeah, what was that like? I mean, it's something that close to you. What was that like for you to experience?
It was scary, because when that stuff drops, not only do you feel the heat effect of it, but you can hear, like, the metal casing, I guess it was, contained into the napalm, fly over your head, you know. You hit a, I tell you, there was a piece that flew right over my, I got so daggone, I couldn't hug the ground anymore, you know. That's how low down, I was scared then.
Yeah.
Plus, a lot of times, like, see, in a lot of your firefights, you don't see the end. The end, there's, because the vegetation is so thick over there. And, like I say, but you got a general idea from the guys that were in the tanks where they were shooting at, and then the spotter plane that was up in the air there. So after about a couple of hours, and things just quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went on our own way.
So this lasted for a couple hours, you say?
Yeah.
Huh. So what are you doing this entire time? I mean, are you firing your rifle? Are you looking for enemy? Are you staying back? What's going on for you?
Well, I'm firing up towards the tree line on top of this hill. Mm-hmm. I figured, well, you know, sometimes they would get up in the trees then, and I'd be firing up there. Not a whole lot of rounds. And then what happened was a few people got hit, and this sergeant, one of the sergeants, and got two of us other guys. We were supposed to get some of the injured and bring them back across the road. Okay, we got so far, we stopped. You know, we got to stop because of firing. And I was on the ground. I was in an open area. And that's where I first seen my first people were shooting at me. You see the rounds going off right in front of you. It's kicking dirt up, you know. And I'm trying to scoot my way back further towards a dirt mound somewhere. I was looking around, and I finally found a dirt mound. We all did, and we finally got back there. But there were some of the other guys that ran the other way across the road, and they happened to get a couple of the injured mountain yard guys and brought them back. And then I had a friend who he didn't feel anything. He doing the initial explosion, he got hit, you know, with one of them mines, hit him pretty bad. And this other guy, he got hit so bad, after the fight, they just picked his body parts up and put the bag.
Mm.
It was one of those orange bags that your mail came in. And they just, like I said, he was just so tore up there, you know, just hard to put the pieces together there.
So after something like this is over, you've experienced this firefight, you're caught in this ambush, and it lasts for quite a while, it sounds like. When it's over, what do you do? Is there a decompression period? Do you stop and think about what's going on? The fear subsides, the adrenaline subsides. What is it like for you once this is over and say you're back at Doctow?
Okay, once it's over with, you know, your body's in high alert, you know. Anything that moves, you can be shooting at, you know. And, of course, you got the helicopter still flying around you, in case, you know, you get another firefight there. But we get back, you know, do our continual work again. You know, we do a little bit more mine sweeping. And then we go so far, and we just jumped in the truck and said, let's go. Just get out of this area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did at that time. And by the time we got back, we just settled in. Yeah, just try to relax, you know, best way we could. You know, we'd drink a couple beers, stuff like this. And we'd get some stuff to read to help take our mind off of it, replenish our ammunition that we'd use. but it was more or less... that particular week, I was in two firefights that particular week.
Hmm.
And I don't know if I was starting to get used to it, or what, I don't know. I just try not to let it get to me.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah. Just try not to dwell on it, I guess.
Right, right. You just had to be on your tip-top shape all the time. You couldn't leave your guard down.
Now, you mentioned that this was the second, that you were involved in two firefights in this week. Can you take me through the second one?
Yeah, the second one was, we got on this one hill again. And what happened is, of course, on these hills connect with other hills through like a little saddle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we set up the bunkers and everything. We didn't have the artillery guys with us, but we had the bordermen with us. And we had about a couple of infantry. We set up a lot of Constantine wire. And then, about the first couple of days, nothing happened. So then what happened was, of course, when the guys from the infantry, they said about five or six guys out to this point, I should say the saddle. And, of course, the postal listened to see if any enemy, what had you. So they were out there, and we got these hit. They happened to come that direction. The NVA was coming up that saddle, and they killed five of the guys. Okay, this one guy played dead there. And what they were doing, the enemy was doing, was taking like the wedding rings off or any jewelry, so they could search into the body, and then they would shoot the guys in the head. When it came to this guy here, because he was telling us, he just played dead. And by the time, some of the other infantry guys back at the perimeter, they got together and start going out to get them guys, rescue them. And they were, of course, all kind of fire and mortar and stuff like that. Shooting going on. And we had like a tunnel that led to the front of our front bumper. Well, I don't know how that got there, to tell you the truth. But anyway, the enemy was coming in that ditch, I should say. And, of course, our guys were shooting as they were coming through. But then you'd have, again, the NVA, they would have, like, a suicide guy. He had a vest satchel charge.
Mm-hmm.
His job was to run and blow as many Americans as he could to the bunker. So, in that situation, like I said, of course, he didn't blow none of the Americans, but he blew himself up, because he didn't get close enough to blow anybody up. And then what happened was it started to get light, and our guys started, running on out towards the point where the other guys were at the listening post. And they seen what happened, and they brought the guy back. And then later on, more stuff was going on. We got into another firefight, and we had a mortar pit right behind us. And these mortar guys were shooting these mortars off. They must have precision. I'll tell you, because they kept joking around. Look at this guy flying a tree. We got that guy. And I can say after a while, after shooting all these mortars off and stuff, they just gave up and took off. And I can say we did happen to get, I think the following day, when they tried to hit us again, we captured two POWs. Of course, they bring them to the interrogate them and put them on helicopters and they fly them out. Where they fly them to, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But then after, I think it was about a day or two later, we all took off, went somewhere else again.
Yeah.
Get back down to Dock 2. So, and then that's when we went, I guess about a day or two later, that's when we went back out to that bent hut to do a mine sweep.
Well, I think we're probably at a good place to stop there for today, Mr. Cates.
Okay. Okay.
This is Kelly Krieger, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Michael Cates. Today is 15 April 2014. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Cates is joining me by telephone from his home in Cincinnati, Ohio. Mr. Cates, you were talking a moment ago before I turned the recorder on about a couple of things about the life there on the fire bases that you wanted to mention. Would you go ahead and start off with that, please?
Yes. I forgot to mention that some of the fire bases that we were on, like say not all of them, we had like four 105 howitzers on there. And what they were used for, what I have seen is like fire support for other fire bases, plus our own protection for our own fire bases there. And like I say, on the bunkers and stuff like that, you know, I've got the area where, you know, we made like steps going into the bunker pump, and we would sleep out four to six people per bunker. Since there's just a handful of us engineers, no more than about nine or ten, we only had two bunkers that we made each time. That's one they had about as far as on the fire bases there.
Mm-hmm.
But other things, like I say, as far as on the fire bases, like I said, we, as far as personnel wise and stuff, like I say, we all joke around and stuff like that during the day and at night time, like I say, sometimes we would get some beer, but of course it'd be warm beer.
Mm-hmm.
So we get that every once in a while, and we would pull jokes on each other. If one guy's at this, be late at night, one guy's go out and had to go use the restroom or what have you. I'd be in habit of pulling his air plug out halfway on his air mattress, but that's what we laid on. We laid on air mattresses, and then we put our sleep bag on top of that. Like I say, when they would come back in, you know, and they lay on the air mattress and even 5 minutes, all of a sudden the plug would pop out, you know, and everybody would be laughing and stuff like that. But everybody got joked on.
Right.
You know, and stuff like that. We all pulled tricks, like shaving cream and whatever. But we had to do something to make things funny.
Sure.
All seriousness.
Right. Yeah, it helped to break the tension and the boredom sometimes as well, I would guess.
Yeah.
Now, you also mentioned that the most of the fighting that you were involved with took place at night. Can you kind of explain what that environment was like to be involved in fighting or firefight at night? What would take place typically?
Okay, typically, sometimes like through intelligence or around the area we were located at, sometimes we were pre-warned that we might be getting hit that particular night. I guess when they captured POWs or whatever, they would tell you what's going on, or just the activity that's around the fire bases at night time. But what normally happens is the NVA works to get around your perimeter, I guess, trying to find a weakness. Okay? And they would do that at night time. And it seems like any time, like about 1 o'clock on, there was like activity around our perimeter. So what the fire, and so once they decided to attack us, most attacks were done around 2 or 3 in the morning, and they would last till about daybreak. Okay, what they would do, they would hit us with rockets and mortars, and then they would be, like, charging up the hill, since we were always on top of the hill. Okay, once it started, you know, flares would go up. Okay, flares gave us, like, daylight, you know. Mortar men would shoot flares up as well as other rounds, and we'd get handheld flares that we used. This way you could see the enemy coming on up. But then once we got attacked, like I say, I guess the command center up on our base would call in artillery from, I guess, other bases,
mm-hmm.
and then he would call in the helicopter gunships. Okay, the helicopter gunships and stuff would come on in, shoot their rockets and machine guns, all around our perimeter are where the command center told where to direct the fire at. Okay. After these gunships, I guess, were running low or something, and there were a few times where the jets would come in. Okay. Jets would come in and bomb around our perimeter, stuff like this. And meanwhile, as everything is going on, flares are being shot up, you know, so it, I guess the planes and gunships and that could see our location within. So the fighting would last more or less till about daybreak, and then they would be more or less over just because of too much in the clear. But like I say, once that starts, your adrenaline is going up real high, and you know, you get all your stuff ready, you know, for the battle there. And like I say, it was like you think, king of the hill, you know, you're on top of the hill, and it's up to him to come up and get you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was a scary time, and I think once adrenaline really kicked in, didn't even think about anything else, but, you know, trying to stay alive.
Yeah. What would you personally be doing? Are you grabbing an M16, helmet goes on the head, out to the perimeter, guarding bunkers? Are you, you know, are you feeding machine guns? What are you personally doing?
Okay, personally, all of us engineers have M16s. And, yes, we would fight. Even though our bunkers were, every once in a while, our bunkers would be on the perimeter line there. But a lot of other times, we were back a little further towards maybe like the command center or somewhere else up on higher ground there. And, yes, when a firefight would start, you know, yes, we would, you know, help support, you know, definitely the infantry, because I could say it's survival. You know, you don't want to take over your firefight, because they're going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there were times where we were in a bunker in this one location where we couldn't get out. You know, every time one of the guys would try to get out, you know, they hit a run right back in because they were being fired on, you know. And the infantry guys would tell us, okay, it's safe enough to come out now and go, you know, to a line or what have you. So that's, we did in that situation. But, yeah, we would pull guard duty and everything else, which, you know, you'd be sitting on the bunker and listen for the enemy and any kind of movement and stuff like that. And there was one time I happened to be going out of the field, you know, and it was my turn, I guess, get the mail. Well, that particular night, I was gone, you know, and some of the engineers were pulling guard duty, and they heard stuff, you know, like somebody walked around until it was pitch black and everything. But you can hear, like, branches were being broken, stuff like this. And you could hear somebody was down over that hill. And, of course, they were probing your perimeter. So one of the guys happened to throw a grenade. And once the, you know, they all they said again, because they said it hurt running like mad, you know, out of the area. But the next day, well, I should say that morning, some officer or what have you in the command, they kicked us off the field for about a day. We weren't supposed to, you know, to fire or do anything until we were, like, fired upon, which is kind of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what happened about a day or later, you know. We of course, we had to go right back on the base again.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we would join right on in, you know, the fight there. So, we were on this one fire base. I don't know if I mentioned the young lady. We had a lieutenant who was killed and two other guys that were badly injured on the firefight there.
Mm.
And what happened on that is the enemy was coming up towards where our 105 howitzers were located at. They were getting in the perimeter right there. And like I say, and like I say, all kind of like mortars or rockets or all kind of explosions were going off. But we had to definitely, you know, be right on line with the rest of the infantry guys.
Yeah. What is it like when you lose someone?
It's kind of tough because we're pretty close. And like I said, because we all joke, I don't care if you were officer or anything. Everybody got along real good. And it was tough, you know, to lose a guy. Like I said, most of the engineers I know was injured pretty good. Just the one officer I know was killed. It was a sad time, because you know they had a family back home, and the guys were young. Like I said, we were 19 years old, 19, 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we just now starting out life, you know. But it wasn't a good thing.
Yeah.
It was a sad time.
Do the rest of you talk about the other individual or the firefighter or what happened that led to his being killed?
Yeah, I found later on that what happened was that the lieutenant and the two other guys, they were assisting on that overword 105's RAT, and like I say, the explosion killed them. Yeah, it killed the one lieutenant, injured the other two real bad. And we talked about that a little bit there. But we've seen some of the other infantry guys being carried off, and then, of course, one fire base, like 24, where we were located. We had a real bad firefight at night there. The bodies, what we did, the NBA bodies, we dragged them down on the side of the hill and left them there, figured hoping maybe that night the NBA would retrieve them dead or something. Well, they didn't do that, so the following day, we had to blow holes up like a crater. Put the bodies in there and bury them up and keep the stink.
Mm-hmm.
It's really bad. Because when flesh is ripped off of a body, it's got a bad, it's a smell you will never forget. You know? And you see pieces of flesh, you know, here and there. And it's really a sickening situation, you know. But there's nothing that you need. Never forget the smell.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, something we didn't talk about last time, I don't believe, since you arrived in country initially in January of 1968, of course, is the Tet Offensive of late January into February, in some cases into March of 1968. Tell me about what you saw during the Tet Offensive. What was going on when you experienced this?
Like I say, I first got over there and everything, and then we got assigned our infantry unit. Like I say, we've seen battles off and on. You know, it wasn't every day consistent or anything like that. It was every once in a while, you know, a firefight. Well, you know, and people were saying something about the Tet Offensive. Well, I didn't know what the Tet Offensive was. I thought fighting was fine. That's what war was all about, you know, with all the shooting and killing going on. But I really didn't pay much attention, you know, about the Tet Offensive, what it was like before the Tet or after the Tet. You know, I really don't know. I thought war was war.
Mm-hmm.
Having all the different battles. So I heard going that Tet Offensive, that's when they were hitting everything, every town, city, fire bases. I thought that was regular routine anyway.
Yeah, and to show up when you did and to see this, you know, pretty much right off the bat, it kind of sets the environment for you, and this is kind of what you expected anyway. I guess for those who were there expecting the ceasefire to, you know, to be observed by all sides, much more of a surprise and maybe perhaps more impactful for them because they had different sets of expectations having been there a little longer. But you arrive, and this is what you're expecting. You're expecting this kind of activity all the time, I guess.
Yeah, I was expecting that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like I say, you know, guys are coming and going all the time. You know, leaving the country, coming to the country. You know, fresh like us. You know, and they would tell a few things here and there, what to watch out for. But the guys that were before me, like they were not in Ted, but they were in their little skirmishes also.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I say, I thought that was just normal routine.
Yeah.
For wartime.
And where were you when the offensive began?
I was in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where I spent all of my time. Was up there in the like I say, it was very mountainous. And it reminded me sort of like the Smoky Mountains down there in Tennessee. You
mm-hmm.
know, beautiful, you know, hilly, stuff like this. But that's where I was at most of the time. And we go from, like I say, we were on the go off and on. And they wouldn't tell us a lot of times. We were going here, we're going there, and but we would never know what to expect once we got to that location.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time we got to our location, time I got in there, like I say, the infantry guys were already scattering out towards the perimeter to make it safer, you know, and the choppers needed to come on in and drop us off, and we'd do our job there. But we never knew how long we were ever going to stay anywhere at one time.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you about the leadership that you were under. What was your opinion of the officers for whom you served specifically and for the overall military leadership in general in Vietnam? What are your impressions of those two?
Okay, we would always have a lieutenant, you know, in charge of us engineers there on the fire base there, and there were always like about a couple sergeants, and the leadership was pretty good, you know. I can't complain about that. You know, they would tell us, you know, well, today we're going to be doing this, doing that here, you know. And, we all knew what to expect, except for when we got some new sergeant that would come in who had a, I remember one time being like 20 years in the service, and I don't know how he ended up in Vietnam, but we were getting into, I don't know, I guess there was mortar rounds coming on in this one fire base, and he kept on standing up, and we'd get done, get your butt down, you know, and he was acting real goofy, you know, and after a while, after a piece of shrapnel flew past him, he finally got the idea, you know, you hug the ground with mortars and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the leadership of our command on the fire bases, I thought they were excellent. You know, I think they knew exactly what they were doing. Whenever we needed fire support, we got it. Whenever we, of course, at times we got replacements coming in. One time we lost quite a few guys, got brought in to make a replacement, and they kept the fire bases up to snuff there. They were very well, you know, trained as officers on what to do in different situations. So I praise high for them.
Yeah. What about the Vietnamese? Did you have the opportunity to interact with either the indigenous personnel there or with Vietnamese military units, the ARVN?
Okay. I spent, like I said, most of my time out in the field every once in a while. We would come on in, or when we were going from one place to another, like to a town or to a village. The Vietnamese people were, I've seen a lot of guys, Vietnamese guys, that should have been in the military fighting for our own country. But it seems like most of them, you know, the ones that I have encountered in my life, where they were like, you know, like pimps for these women, stuff like this.
Hmm.
And that's what really got me mad, you know, because these guys should be fighting for their own country, you know, instead of doing what they're doing. And now that was the civilian, South Vietnamese. Like I say, when there was only one time where I had to have had an operation with the South Vietnamese Army, That was my last admission. When I was over there, we had about two companies of South Vietnamese Army personnel with us. And I think it was about, well, I'm just taking a guess here, about a company or two of American guys with us. And we were on a mission close to the Cambodian border, destroying this road base. And we were told before we took off if we ever got into a firefight, and the South Vietnamese Army guys would take off and run because they were known to do that, as we were told to shoot them.
Hmm.
And I couldn't visualize that, you know, because I never had any dealings with them before.
Yeah.
Well, it never happened, or, you know, anything. But, that's what we were told to do if we did get skirmish.
Mm-hmm.
To me, you know, something tripped our trip flares off that night, and they stood their ground. You know, of course, we had to tell them to quit wasting our ammo, but because the shooting got you nothing, they couldn't see what they were shooting at.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't shoot no flares off and let everybody know we were right in that area there. So, but that's the only dealings I ever had with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking about combat fighting, which obviously should go without saying, pretty important part of this experience, of course. But let's take you away from the fighting for a little bit. Did you get the opportunity to take an R&R?
Sure did. It was about I was probably out in the field for 7 months before I got my first in-country R&R.
Mm-hmm.
And we took that down. I took that down in Vung Tau. That was south of Saigon. Well, I never heard of Vung Tau before, and it must be a safe area and relaxation and stuff, because otherwise they wouldn't be sending GIs down there. So I hopped on the plane and took me on down there, and it was like, I don't know if it's like a USO, or they had this big building for the GIs down there. And man, I tell you, you talk about seeing some delicious food. I tell you, we fought over a hamburger, you know.
Is that right?
Hamburgers look good, fresh fruit, stuff that we wouldn't see, you know. They even actually have a steak sandwich, you know. What the heck is a steak? But it was really nice the way they set that up down there. We could eat any food whenever we wanted to. We actually had a bed to sleep on with pillows and sheets, take a shower, which was a luxury right there, you know, instead of taking your bath out of a steel pot all the time. And like I say, then at nighttime they had entertainment, they had a band, and playing, of course, American songs. And during the daytime, you could, you know, walk around the area, feel safe, the town and everything, and, you know, buy what you want to buy. It's right by the, I guess that was the ocean there, and I'm attracted to water anyway, because I love water. And I just, you know, just relax, just look out there on the beach, and just relax, take it easy. That meant the world. We're good. And, you know, we did that, I think it was only like a 5 days, maybe. I can't remember. But, yeah, you can buy stuff, whatever you want to, and intermingle with the people there, you know. And, people are very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So, I felt very, very safe there.
Yeah. What about an out-of-country R&R? Did you have an opportunity to leave the country?
Yes, I guess my 8th month there, I went to Australia.
Australia? Why did you choose Australia?
Well, first of all, American people. well, not American people, but, you know, people similar, you know, to Americans speak English, mm-hmm. put it that way.
Yeah.
And I heard, you know, some of my friends who went over there, how nice it was, how beautiful, and how the people were very friendly towards the GIs, and And when I was over there, I we had the nightclub and stuff like that to hit at night. I actually went deep sea fishing one time over there, which was not a pleasant experience. You know, I got seasick as well as quite a few other guys.
Huh.
Should have never went out. The waves were so daggone high, you know, bouncing the boat around, but you couldn't fish. And I said, my God, I don't want to die in the ocean. I said, stand up being shot on land, but come to the ocean, almost drown, you know. I said, I don't like this stuff. But the captain took us on back, and then we went horseback riding, and excuse me. And then, like I say, met a couple girls over there, you know, and they took us to their house, so, and they were extremely friendly people, and like I say, they ate all kind of food I could eat. You know, stuff that I knew I wouldn't be able to get once I get back over in Nam. But then and they had the beach, and a friend of mine I went over there with, you know, we spent some time on the beach. And I really enjoyed that Amazon. I called my mom, by the way, when I was over in Australia. And I forgot what the time zone difference, but I woke her up.
Mm-hmm.
But she could care less. She said, you can call me anytime, you know. I said, well, I knew that. So she said, I don't care how much it costs, this phone, you just keep on talking, you know, because it's good to hear your voice.
Yeah. That must have been pretty special.
Yeah, it was. It was. And just, of course, you don't forget your own home phone number.
Right.
You're just trying to, you know, go through the operator and say, I'm going to make a collect call to Cincinnati, Ohio, and person I want to talk to. I can imagine being woke up in the middle of the night and who's calling? but yeah, that was a good thing, you know, like I said, the service did for us, and it gives an in-country as well as out of the country on.
Yeah. Was it difficult to go back after the R&R?
Well, I really didn't want to, but I knew I had to.
Right.
So... yeah, that's funny. When I was about ready to leave, I got paid about 2 weeks left in the field, and the lieutenant told me to get out of here, you know, go back to the base camp, spend the rest of your time there. And so I did, and I think a couple of days I was there, I happened to get my extra stripe, you know, of Spec 5. Yeah.
Okay.
For the whole time, but when I was a senior demolition man, that was a level 5 slot, and I was still on that for about 3 months. And it took a long time for me to make ranks anyway over there. But I finally, I went over with the private and came back to Spec 5.
Mm-hmm. Now, working in the Central Highlands as you were, did you have any contact with the Montagnard people there?
Yes, I did.
Tell me about the Montagnards. What was your experiences like with them?
Okay, the Montagnard people were similar to what I would say the American Indians. You know, they stayed away from the South Vietnamese people. They set up their grass or straw huts that they would make. And, their everyday life was, you know, they would do fishing, and whether or not they did gardening or not, I don't know, but I would see them, you know, on the roadways, and they would have this real long pole with the basket on each end, and sometimes it had water in it, and other times, I guess, probably food, you know, in there. But, of course, they didn't wear anything from the waist up, you know. And I was always told, don't mess around with a mountain yard girl, you know, if you ever had any opportunity, you know, because like I say, the father would try to kill you, from what I heard, you know. But they were very good people. There was a special forces camp that we went to, Ben Hutt there, that trained mountain yard people. And from what I saw several of them that they looked like they were very good fighters. That's all I can remember. Like I say, there's only about a couple instances I've been around with them, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. So you get back from your R&R, I guess it's probably, what, October, something like that, of 1968?
Uh-huh.
All right. Now, you have until the end of the year, basically, or January of 69. By this time, are you considering yourself as to be a short-timer?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me what it's like to be a short-timer in Vietnam.
Okay. It felt good, but, you know, first of all, you've got a lot of experience behind you, mm-hmm. you know, from all the operations that I was on. And whenever we would get some fresh troops on in for our replacements, stuff like this, you know, some of the guys would say, well, hang around with Kate. He knows exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, that made me feel good there, you know. I sort of lost my track thought there, you know. As the short track timer there. And we would have our helmet. We would always have our state written on our helmet, you know. So this way, if somebody else was, like, from Ohio, you know, of course, we'd read, find out. And that's how we had our conversations with other infantry people. Because
mm-hmm.
there were so many other guys, I wouldn't know half the people think, because I wasn't that close to the infantry as I was our own people here. And we would have every day of the month, you know, like January, February, March, and each month we would cross out on our band. We have a band around our helmet to have the camouflage helmet on there. And we would scratch a month off. And, you know, people would tell how you get to be a short timer. So I said, yeah, I'm getting more cautious, too.
Tell me about that. I think that's a very interesting phenomenon. What would it mean to be a short timer and how you approached your work there, your job?
Well, being a short timer, like I say, the closer it was time for me to get out of country, the more cautious I was. And, like I say, as far as doing the explosives, well, I couldn't take no cautions there. Like I used to tell my boys, you did stuff right, or I wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no second guessing about messing with the explosives or being over there on the fight and stuff. You had to do things right. And being a short timer, like I say, you want to get out of the field more, you know, so you weren't shot at anymore, or, you know, you have to go on very many more missions. But all you had to do is you had to be more careful, cautious.
And of course, working in with explosives, demolitions, or with demolition, you were, like you say, definitely trained, predisposed, as it were, to be cautious anyway. Can you tell me about what kind of demolitions equipment you're working with? You mentioned before, you know, mine sweeping and clearing mines and roads and things like that. But tell me about the tools of the trade for an engineer.
Okay. Most of the time, if we needed to make like a trash pit or something like this, we would have shape charges. What shape charges do, they blow straight holes down from the ground, probably about 5-6 feet down, I would guess there. And then you would put a crater charge in there, and then you would blow them up, and they would create your big hole. Okay. Excuse my sinuses are racking up there.
I understand.
And and so the... yeah, I lost my background. Could you repeat the question?
Sure. I was just curious about the types of equipment you're working with, the kinds of explosives, C4, Decor, things like that.
Okay. And on the we carried a lot of C4 with us.
Mm-hmm.
We carried Decor with us, fuses, and we carried blasting caps with us. So we needed all that stuff in order to grow like trees or make our flue gas bomb. I got saying last time how we used to make that stuff around the perimeters. It's like napalm. And like I say, we didn't use the explosives every day. It wasn't every day. We would use, like I say, most times C4 for everything. We did have some dynamite, but whenever we had a blow up, like a bunker up, some of that we used most of C4 because it had more of an explosive power to it. And the dead cord, like I say, it was that you had to be careful on that stuff there too, but everything needed to be blasting cap before it went off.
Mm-hmm.
So there was times like some of the infantry guys, you know, we would joke around with them at times. We'd get probably a block of C4, probably weighed about close to a pound, and we'd say, "Here you go, guys, catch them C4," and they'd run like mad. And we would just laugh because we didn't have no regular. There wasn't no blasting cap, and it won't explode.
Right.
But they didn't know that, you know. A couple times of that, they just, you know, just started laughing at us. Oh, we know your little tricks now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we pulled jokes on them a little bit.
Yeah. Well, as your time approaches to leave Vietnam here at the end of 68, early 69, what becomes of your attitude toward the war, toward your job? Are you going out still every day and doing what you've got to do? Or you mentioned being a little more cautious about things, perhaps not wanting to go out in the field and be shot at, which is obviously something we can all understand, I'm sure. What about, again, as the short timer, what does your attitude toward the war become? Are you just looking to get home, to get out? What is it like to be working in this environment with such little time left in Vietnam?
Well, like you said, the main thing is get the heck out of there.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that seems to be on your mind when you're a short timer over there. And I can tell you, you're just a lot more cautious.
Mm-hmm.
And you're praying that you don't have any more firefights or any more being mortared or what have you, the enemy. You just hope things go smooth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and get out of the field as soon as you can.
Yeah. When did you finally get out of the field?
Probably about, I probably got out of the field about 2 to 3 weeks before my end of tour over there.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, I went down to, they flew me in down to Doc Tho down there. And I'd stay down there at times, I guess for about a week before my time to get out of the country. So then I would go by convoy to Pleiku. Just like when I came to Doc Tho, when I first came in country, we went by convoy. And so when we were going through the towns, you know, and everything, this would be the last time I see this bridge. This is the last time I see this town. And last time I see these people right on the Kontum right there. Because Kontum was a town between Pleiku and Doc Tho. And it was just a wonderful feeling just to get out of the field. And I like to say that that's how I got my to go to, you know, relax, get party it up, get some fans to go see. They had actually a movie house there that had it, well, as we call it, with a big tent, all these chairs and shoot movies. And they would let you know when there would be a movie playing. And I remember one time they had the Green Beret with John Wayne. We came out of the field one time and stopped filming.
What do you think of it?
I tell you what, after about 40 minutes of that movie, we just got up and we left. We just thought it was so daggone fakey, it wasn't even fun, you know. See, John Wayne should have been shot out of that helicopter a long time ago. So, yeah, throughout the whole movie, we were making all kind of comments. You gotta be kidding me, you know. That'll never happen, you know. And like I say, after a while, we just all got up and we just walked out, you know. It's just been taking for that fakiness there.
Yeah. Well, tell me the process by which you derose, you come home from overseas. What is the process for you? You're back in the rear to some degree here. When do your orders come in? What is the process by which you leave Vietnam?
Okay, once we come out of the field, and like I say, when I ended up and back into play two there, that's when I had to give up my rifle. Boy, I didn't like that, you know, because that rifle was with you 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to give up my ammo. And I felt very insecure then, you know. That rifle was part of me, you know. I didn't really want to give it up. But they made us give it up. And then once we turned that stuff in, we turned, we didn't turn any clothes in because it was hard enough to get clothes over there to wear. And like I say, then we take our showers and stuff like that. And then every day we have formation, which wasn't very many guys at all anyway. And we were more or less waiting for our orders, where we were going to go, we'll come stateside. So once we get our orders, you know, found out, well, I was going to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and the date I was going to leave the country, and because once I got the orders, then all I had to do is hop on the plane there and play two, and it put me back down to Vung Tau, not Vung Tau, but Tan Sanhu. And then I just waited there for, I think I stayed there probably about 3 days before our, like I say, an airliner jet, that's what I'm going to call, because that's what it looked like. They didn't have no markings like Delta or what had on there. And all of us guys got on there, you know, and we were happy as can be. A lot of guys were crying and that. And we happened to fly out at night. I believe it's towards the evening time there. They kept telling us we have to wait until we get the okay, because I don't know if they were shooting mortars at the planes at one time or what, I don't know, but we had to wait for a while, and then we just, you know, the plane just took off, and up in the air we went, you know, and everybody was yelling, screaming, happy as can be.
Yeah.
So, but like I say, back there, like we just wait around, just read, and go to nightclubs at night, just, you didn't want to get anything from the, PX, because that means you'd have to haul it home, and you can get that stuff here in the States. That's the only thing I can remember right now.
Yeah. Well, after this long plane ride home, where do you come back into the United States?
I got back into, I think it was Spokane, Washington. That was pretty close to Fort Lewis. And I remember we got there about midnight, and once we got there, we had to go process, of course, name, rank, everything else, and then they paid you because you were going to be on leave for, I think I was on leave for about 30 days, and they gave you your pay, and that's the first time I've seen a $100 bill. How in the world am I going to cash a $100 bill? You know, but that's how they're paying big bills like that. And then, okay, then they took us to the airport, a commercial airline airport, and then everybody was like on their own, trying to find a way how to get home. So then I would go to different airlines. You got a flight going to Cincinnati. You got a flight going some, you know, close to Cincinnati. And I actually spent about 1.5 to 2 days at the airport to get a flight out of there. I was sleeping. I remember sleeping in the airport. And I actually got a flight to Greater Cincinnati Airport, and I hopped on KF there. And he took me downtown Cincinnati, and then I had to get on another KF. Greater Cincinnati Airport, that's really in Kentucky. It's not in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess at the time, the KF could only take me downtown Cincinnati, and then from Cincinnati, I could grab a Cincinnati KF and take me wherever I wanted to go. So what I did, I called my brother up once I got into downtown and told him I'm in town and I'm coming over to his house. So, because I wanted to surprise my mom.
Oh, she didn't know you're coming back yet.
Nope. Nope. I, hid that from her too. So, yeah, like anything, keep her from worrying. That I was her favorite. I gotta miss that, you know. So, yeah, I got to my brother's house and his wife. He had one or two kids at the time. And it was, it was late at night. I remember that. And I remember something going off in the street. I don't know, somebody had firecrackers or what have you. Boy, I hit the floor, and I was looking, where's my gun? You know, excuse me. Until I realized, you know, I'm back in the States here, you know.
Yeah.
So after a while, you know, everything cooled down, and... So I went back room there where they got bunk beds back through there. And I don't know how late I slept. I slept to all the way, like I say, I don't know how late it was that night. So I know they actually had to wake me up about 7 o'clock that evening. He said he didn't want me to sleep any later because I slept so long, you know, like that. Well, I haven't eaten. Sleeping so long, and, you know, just laying in the bed is a world. That's a whole new world to me anymore.
Yeah.
So then it was around right up to New Year's there. It was January the 6th, I think it was. So, and that's when my mom still had a Christmas tree up. And then they stopped me in the front door. And then my mom was out in the kitchen fixing food. So then, here I have my uniform on. And then, so my brother said, and I had a lot of my other family there also, say, and they called my mom in. And then they told her, come on in the front room here. You know, once somebody meets you, you know. Well, she took a quick glance and didn't think who I was. And then she turned again. And oh, boy. See what's happening. Right. It's a, you know, developmental moment there.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. It must really have been something for you and your family, especially your mother, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, what sort of things did you do when you got back? You have 30 days of leave. What sort of things are you doing now that you're back in the world?
Okay, I start to call my friends up. And home, I was back and everything. I went to my high school and met some old friends there. And after school, that one day there, you know, we went to this all girls school called Mercy High School. That was when Catholic school girls went to there, you know. And I knew a few girls who were going to school there. So then we waited after school, and I was in the driveway when the kids were being released. And here these two girls that knew before, they just looked, you know, like, who am I? You know? And they think, well, you don't remember who I look like, you know? And then once this girl named Katie, she was so glad before she ran up and they gave the biggest hug and kiss and glad to see me and everything. Is we have to get together and do things while you're home. And so I said, yeah, that's what we're going to do. I said, I got a few days. I said, no, I'm going to, you know, take advantage of
Yeah.
So, like I said, I did a lot of sleeping and resting. Got my pictures from my brother, you know, that I sent Katie to develop for me. And it was still wintertime out there. I wasn't used to that cold weather, you know, because it was so hot over in Vietnam over there. But it was more or less just going to movies, go to dances, go out to eat, stuff like that, visit relatives, get in my car and drive again. So that was a whole new experience right there. It felt kind of funny to get behind the wheel again and drive.
Hmm.
So, but that's about what I was doing.
Yeah. What is it like for you, having been in combat and been in these circumstances for a year in Vietnam, to come back home where it's peaceful, where people aren't trying to kill you? You mentioned this episode with firecrackers or whatever may have been unnerved you a little bit. What's it like to be back in the world, out of the war zone?
Well, like I say, safety was the main thing. And like I said, back then also, you had what you call the boonies, you know, demonstrations against the war. But luckily, that was like in D.C., it wasn't in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt very safe here.
Yeah. What did you think about the anti-war demonstrations?
I don't like that at all. You know, like I say, we're giving up our lives to, you know, the three other people being a communist role there. And all these kids, but they didn't have the slightest idea what the heck was going on over there. All they wanted to do is be on the bandwagon. Oh, we'll just protest this, protest that. No, we didn't care for it. And when I was stationed here at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, we were actually trained into riot training. And they would tell us exactly what to do, because there might be a time where we have to go into D.C. and break up the protests and stuff like this. And one time we were called into D.C., but we never did get onto the streets because the police had everything under control. You'd be a little leery of wearing your uniform at the airports that you've been into, because that's where they had a lot of these demonstrators located at. They would try to give you a kiss, you know, they put this like a lay or something around you and try to kiss you, and then but then some people would call you baby killers, potheads, and you know, I'd never had anybody spit on me, but I've heard of instances where, you know, guys were spit on because they wore their army uniform.
Mm-hmm.
So, but no, I didn't care for all the protests, so.
Yeah. You were to remain in the Army for a number of years in addition to your tour in Vietnam. Did you continue to keep up with the war, what was going on over there?
Yeah, not as much, though. Like I say, if we didn't see what was going on the news, I guess we would read it in the newspapers. But the Army didn't tell you anything about what was going on. I guess maybe they didn't want you to know. I don't know. But I know my last 6 months I had left in the States, they tried to send a few of us guys over to Germany, and we couldn't figure out why you sending us now. So by the time you process us, it'd be time to come back home.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And yeah, they finally wised up and said, forget it, you guys ain't going to Germany. I didn't want to leave the States here. I was having to be going with a girl at the time.
Yeah. What did you think about the way the United States ended its participation in the war, and then the fall, you know, all the way through the fall of Saigon? What were your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I didn't really keep up with it all the time. And when they were talking about the fall of Saigon there, I kept trying to visualize, well, what happened? You know, how did all the North Vietnamese get down from the north and on down to the south so fast, you know? And how were they taking all these towns that were secured by the, the Americans were over there. I guess it's all over the South Vietnamese. And I just couldn't figure out how in the world did they lose their country over there.
Mm-hmm.
And because you figure we had the best fighting equipment you could have. You know, we had aircraft, we had artillery, and Lord, we had planes, you know, stuff like that. The Vietnamese didn't have that stuff. You know, they had the mortars and the rockets, and they didn't have planes. And at the time, I did not see any tanks. I heard there were tanks over there. But I did not personally see any. And I just couldn't figure out how they were, they lost Saigon. And I seen the helicopters, you know, picking up people. I made everybody in the world wanted to get out of there because they were afraid what the heck the North Vietnamese were going to do. I guess they all figured they were going to be wiped out. I'm sorry to see, you know, that happen over there.
Mm-hmm. You remained in the Army, I believe, until, 1973, isn't that correct?
Yeah. I had 3 years of active. So this was like 67, 68, 69. And then, 70. I got out in 70.
Mm, okay.
And then I had 3 years of inactive. I mean, so if you did military service, like Vietnam and stuff, you did not have to go to these monthly meetings that they would have. That's what I call 3 years of inactive service.
Mm-hmm.
If I belong to the Army Reserve or Coast Guard, stuff like that, or not Coast Guard, but National Guard, then I would have to go to meet the once a month training. But since I was in combat, I didn't have to.
Yeah. What was your view of the American military once you came home from Vietnam? We hear stories about, you know, a breakdown in morale and discipline and all kinds of legal problems, drug issues, racial issues. What was, in your experience, what was your view of the military life once you came home from the war?
I mean, once I got out of the military?
Well, even as soon as you get back from Vietnam and in this time inactive.
Uh-huh. Well, my inactive time, like I said, I just do like regular civilian life there. You know, I just kind of go try to find a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I knew I wasn't going to be going back in or making any meetings or whatever. But I really didn't. At the time, I can't remember. I can't think where I really paid that much attention to what was going on later on. Or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
So what did you do once you separate from the Army?
Okay, well, I was trying to find excuse me again. Well, I was trying to find a job in construction. But at that particular time, the unemployment was very high. And people just weren't hiring, so I tried to get any job I possibly could. I wanted to be unemployment office. And I happened to get a job at a machine shop. And I did that for probably about 2 months. And then I got a job from a post office. And before I got out of the service, I took the test for the post office. Hopefully, when I got out, you know, I'd get right into the post office or a government job, which would be secure. And you know, I was about laying off. And, knew I was going to have money coming in and stuff like that. So that's more or less what happened to me there.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any trouble adjusting to life after the Vietnam War?
Not really. At one time, well, I had a hard time finding a job and stuff. I actually thought about going back into service. And figured, well, I know I'm going to have medical. I'm going to get a paycheck, you know, and stuff like that. But the only drawback is I knew I'd be going back over to Vietnam again. There was no way in the world I was going to go through that again.
Right.
So that's why I didn't join back up in the Army again.
What about post-Vietnam life, from the time you get back to, say, even today? Are you interested in the war itself? Do you read about the war when you get a chance? Do you watch any movies about the Vietnam War, anything like that?
Yeah, I still watch some documentaries on TV. But when they were coming out with these Vietnam movies, I wouldn't watch them. And there was one or two I watched, and one wasn't too bad. I think it was called Apocalypse Now, I think was the name of it. But there was another one, man, it hit right on what I was doing, fighting at nighttime, and, you know, the Vietnamese running all over the place. You know, I had a turn. I couldn't have watched it. But it hit home on me. Yeah, I'll never watch it. I tell you what, I haven't watched a Vietnamese movie in a long time. Because I don't want to bring back some of that stuff that went on over there.
Yeah.
I try to keep that back as far as I can in my mind. But then you would tell people, you know, like, say, where I worked at, you know, they'd ask, you know, what went on here and there. You'd tell them, and they wouldn't believe you. And that's because you weren't over there, you know. And so I just clamped down. I said, I'm not going to talk to anybody else about this unless it's another veteran, you know. And that's what I did. I didn't, for the longest time, I didn't talk to people about Vietnam whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because people wouldn't believe you.
What about with your family?
Well, with my family, no, I very seldom discussed it. My oldest boy, one time, he asked a couple of questions, you know, and I tried to explain to him, you know, what my job was and how it was like over there. But my youngest boy, you know, didn't show no interest whatsoever. And I had a niece down in North Carolina down there in high school. She had to do a report, like some of the things in Vietnam. And I talked to her and what was going on and stuff. Some of the stupid junk that had to be done. But she made a report about it. But after that, I think, I really don't talk about it. You know, when us guys eat like on Friday morning at McDonald's. Now, every once in a while, we'll discuss something, you know. But a lot of times, you know, we don't bring a whole lot up.
Yeah. Do you find it difficult to talk about the war?
Not a whole lot. If people really want to know about it, you know, I would try to explain to them the best way I could. It's just like on the job interview. I'm on the phone in this interview here. It's hard to describe everything in detail without leaving stuff out. And, you know, more like you have to fill in the blanks. But really, I don't talk about it. I try to, like I say, especially my family. You know, and that's funny. You mentioned something about family. My wife at the time, her and my sister-in-law thought I had post-traumatic stress syndrome, you know. Well, you figure, because I was very disciplinary with the boys, and but one thing led to another. I guess my sister-in-law brainwashed my wife, and then me being a fisherman, you know, I like going fishing trips and stuff like this, or, you know, and, you know, well, you're cheating and stuff like this. And I think that's what ended up my divorce, stuff like that, because I was too disciplinary with kids and stuff like that. thought. I think that's a little so on, but no, how did I come up and think I had post-traumatic syndrome? I don't know.
Well, I've got just a couple more questions for you, if you don't mind, Mr. Cates. And they're pretty general questions, so please feel free to answer them in as broad or as narrow terms as you like. The first question is, as you look back on all these years later, how do you think your experiences in the Vietnam War most affected your life?
I think some of it, that my strictness, I think some of it has to do part of the Vietnam War. You couldn't mess up over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were given orders to do stuff and you had to do them. I ain't going to do that. You can't say nothing like that.
Yeah.
And I think that part, you know, being strict, I think part of it. Because if you didn't do things right over there, you know, you'd be dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd go walking around like there's nothing going on over there. But that's the only thing I can think of it for right now.
Yeah. Well, then my last question for you, also pretty broad. As we look back on the Vietnam War, 45, 50 some odd years ago, we still struggle as a nation, as a society, to determine exactly what it was Vietnam meant. What are the lessons we were supposed to have learned? What lessons did we learn? And in general, just what was the legacy of the Vietnam War? So let me put it to you, someone who was there for a tour, someone who served honorably, someone who was in combat, saw a lot of things you didn't expect to see growing up in Cincinnati. What do you think is the war's lasting impact, the legacy of the Vietnam War?
Well, I can say the main reason why I went over is trying to fight communists.
Mm-hmm.
The freedoms that we had, freedom of religion, freedom of press, freedom of speech, stuff like that. And then when that didn't happen, you know, since the North Vietnamese took over, you know, the country, which is, right now, I've known people who have gone over to South Vietnam already and see what it was like, you know, and you're not allowed to roll over the place over there. But they say things are going along really well over there, which is good. They've got industry going on over there, because I know a lot of our furniture is made in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, that's I guess the people are being treated okay, you know, because I never hear anything bad going on over there. Not like there was one in South Vietnam. I should say one in the North. They went into Cambodia, you know, and did a lot of killing over there. You just don't hear a whole lot about Vietnam anymore. And like I say, it's sorry to say that we lost the war over there. But that's, I guess, a lot had to do with the South Vietnamese. They should have better, harder of their country.
Yeah.
It's the only thing I can think of right now.
Well, Mr. Cates, is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview before we draw it to a close?
Yeah, I'd like to, also, is one of our daily routines over there, we would take, like, malaria pills. So before we left to go to Vietnam, you know, you got all kind of shots in the arm and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But every day you would take like a malaria pill. On Mondays, you would take a big orange pill, and in the rest of the days we could take a little white pill, you know, for malaria. Well, that didn't work too good for me one time, because we were going on this one mission. Like I said, I didn't know where in the heck we were going again. And I told the doc and the sergeant, I'm not feeling good. You know, something's wrong. And the place that we got to, we were in like a crater. You know, I guess one of the bombs were in a crater. And there was fighting going on at the hill, but we were trying to take this one hill. And so I said, I am really wiped out. You know, I can't do it. I'm sick as a dog. And the doc checked me out and he said, we got to get him out of here. So I was burning up and stuff like this. So they called a helicopter in for me. And they evacuated me out of there to the hospital. And I forget how high my fever was. I was vomiting all over the place. And they kept taking blood tests all the time. And they wouldn't say exactly I had malaria. They said I was pretty close to it. Hmm. You know. And then the diseases, like I say, I got worms over there. You know, and they had to be cleaned out. I had to take special medicine to wipe the worms out of my system there. But, yeah, they were going to, in fact, take me. If I didn't break the fever, I had it for a good week. And at the time, they said if I wouldn't break it that particular day, then they were going to evacuate me to another medical hospital. So much for the malaria pills.
Yeah, I guess so, huh? Have you had any lingering effects of that?
No, I haven't.
Hmm.
Thank goodness for that. But, no, I came back all in one piece. Lost my hearing for 2 weeks over there, so I got that back. But like I say, I still got my arms and legs and everything else. So I'm fine on that.
Hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think of anything right now. I'm sure by the time I hang up, I'll think of something.
Well, if that's the case, then you can always call back and we can add it on later. That's no problem.
Okay. Yeah, but like I say, I came back with some pictures and stuff there, you know, when I was checking out of the Vietnam over through there before we got on the plane. They went through all of our stuff. They were confiscating all the cameras, any film and stuff like this. Back in the state to see what was going on or what stuff looked like over there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you lose anything?
They took my camera.
Mm-hmm.
It was an Instamatic 110. Yeah, I used to carry that with me, and because of the jungle fatigue, they would give you head side pockets and mm-hmm. put it down there. And oh, that's another thing, clothing. It was, if you could get clothing once a week, you were doing good. You know, you would keep the same socks on for a week, like that, your clothes on, you know, dirty. It was just a joy just to get clean clothes. Toothpaste was a commodity, you know, if you got out of the field there to get the toothpaste, that was great. we would get, out in the field at times, we would get these great big boxes, what's called SP packs, they would call them. Boxes, SP boxes. And what it was a box full of cigarettes, cigars, and all kind of candy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I first tried to see what it was like to smoke, you know. And I took a couple cigarettes and smoked them. This is not for me because I was allergic to smoke. Mm-hmm. And my eyes would water. So, but I had it available to me free from the government. It didn't cost me anything. And whenever, like I said, I used to keep candy bars on me, and whenever we would go through a village, which was very seldom, you know, I'd give the kids candy bars.
Mm-hmm.
So, but as far as, like I say, when you're out in the field, as far as cleanliness and that, you've got a steel pot filled up with water, and then, you know, you wash your face, underneath your arms, shave. That's how you used to clean until you got to a river, which is very seldom we ever got to clean. When I did, I was a little leery anyway. If I get in a river, somebody's going to be shooting on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So I was leery about that.
Sure.
But we always had to wait until we got back to camp in order to get showers, which was cold showers, by the way. But they hang this special bucket up there full of water, and it had like a shower head on there. You stand underneath there and get wet and let it down. And that was funny how I would think about how you would go to the bathroom out there and the bases and stuff. Well, of course, I told you, you know, last time that we would make what we call shitters, you know, two or three people one time to sit in one. But what we did also is, as engineers, I don't know what the infantry guys did, but we put a barrel down into the ground, put a tube down there, and you had to go take a leak. You stand out there and just leak. And then you think about it later on, well, shoot, you could have been knocked off, you know. but you don't think about that at the time.
Right.
So but
it'd be best that you wouldn't think about it, I would think.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I could really think of right now. My experiences over there. It was like I say, when I first got off the plane, when I first went over there, when we got off the plane and we took a bus ride through the town of Lakeview, I remember seeing this. We had stopped for something, but I seen this one young girl. Like blood going down, and they all wear black clothes over there, and I see blood running down towards her feet, and I thought, oh my God, whatever, that was sickening, you know. I don't know if that's her time of the month or what, you know. Well, I tell you, and all the diseases the Army would teach you about, you know, stay away from the women, and that which hold true for the, we used to have a medic. He was out of the field more than he was in the field. And every time he'd go out the daggone field, he would, you know, get a girl, and he didn't have it catching BD. Third time he caught that, they couldn't cure it. So we lost him. Well, you know, we never get him replaced. But like I say, the diseases he had to watch out for over there, like they kept talking about malaria, which, like I say, I don't know who else had what I had. I couldn't tell you. As far as wildlife, we would see bamboo fibers at times. They hit you, you're dead. Mm-hmm. They were that poisonous over there. And the when we came out of the field, Doc Joe down there, they used to have a monkey down there. And he used to climb up on your head and look for bugs in your head. I'd be afraid of it. This time I'm going to bite them. I'm in trouble. You know.
Was he sort of a mascot for the unit, or just what was that?
I don't know how the guys got a hold of it. You know, we hit guys out of the field. You know, I don't know, I guess for getting our mail, headquarters, stuff like this, communications, stuff like that. We hit, and I don't know how in the world they got monkey, but they did. It was friendly for everybody. Never did see it fight, but we never did take it out in the field. I've heard of guys taking dogs out there in the field, which I think would have been a really good idea, because they can sense all kind of dangers.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any experience with any of the dogs out there?
No, the only dog was actually we had a dog down at Doc Toe, down at the base camp down there. But they didn't leave them outside the area too well, because they said the Vietnamese people eat dogs. You never see a cat, but they said they'll definitely eat a cat. And but they said they eat dogs also over there. I don't know why they didn't eat rats. My God, there were so many rats over there. I don't care where you went. You know, you'd go to a fire base, dig a hole, and stuff like that. You'd have rats somehow. And when we come out of the field, you know, we slept in a big tent. And at nighttime, you could hear the rats running all over the place, all night long. And there were times out in the field, of course, you slept with that, took your boots off if you could. But you'd have rats in there. I had one time pull on my sock, you know, and I had my sock on. You know, you think that was scared. Yeah. we would have the chaplain come out every once in a while in church service. Over there, I carried a Bible in my top pocket all the time, a little small one, service area.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can think of as of right now.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and put an end to it then.